The Brendan O'Connor Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Discover a team that's always here to support you at All Care, taking care of communities across Ireland.
Now, look, as I was saying, lots more in the papers today about the mother and baby homes and more terribly sad stories. And I think, in a way, the reason that women are still telling these stories is because I think a lot of them felt they were not heard in that process, and that they were not heard maybe in the report and the reaction to it. And there's a fair amount of soul searching in the papers today as well about the church and the state, and like I think about us as a people. Dr. Mary McAleese joins me now. Good morning, Mary.
Good morning. How are you doing, Brendan?
I'm good, thanks. Mary, can I read you something from, it's a piece by Paul Williams in today's Indo. I don't know if you've heard of this documentary. It's been flying around online the last week or two. It was a documentary made in 1967 called The Rocky Road to Dublin.
And it was I read about it today for the first time.
Yeah, it sounds brilliant. And it's a Dublin-born journalist, Peter Lennon. And the question that he posed was, what do you do with your revolution once you've got it, right? But Sean O'Fallon gave this assessment of the new republic. The society that actually grew up was a society, since independence, he means, was a society of urbanised peasants, a society that was without moral courage, constantly observing a self-interested silence, never speaking in moments of crisis, a constant alliance with a completely obdurate, repressive, regressive and uncultivated church. Which I think is a good summing up of it. Now, Mary, some of the criticism of the report and of the government's response this week was that there was too much of an emphasis on blaming society and not the church and state. Do you think, was everyone complicit in this Irish kind of culture of secrets and lies, or did the church create that culture?
I think the church was more complicit than most, and a subservient state was complicit with the church. And the description of the people, O'Fallon's description, is on the one hand, it's harsh because it leaves out one element that's very important. It's left out in many, many, I think, many of the analyses of what happened and what continues to happen here. And that is the relationship between people and church, because that relationship, and I'm talking here about the Catholic Church, though indeed
you broke for one crucial second there. Did you say the relationship between who and the church?
Between the people, yeah. The people and the church, members of the church. And as you know, all of the Christian churches are implicated here in the story that is told in the report. But the church that I belong to, the Catholic Church, which represents the majority here, imposed a culture of fear on uneducated people. And it told them emphatically that by baptism, they were obliged to obey the teaching of their church. And they had no choice in that. They were also told that by baptism, they had to remain members of that church for life. So in other words, from day one, their right to information, that was curtailed by the church. Their right to freedom of conscience, they didn't have that. The church told them that they would inform their conscience. Their rights to freedom of opinion, that was gone because that was subservient to obedience to the bishops. So, and that continues to this day, incidentally. I mean, that is still the church's teaching. So the difference today, of course, is that we're educated largely now, and we're also educated about our rights, so we can, you know, we can argue back.
But you think that you think that those same underlying conditions, if you will, in the church that caused all this terrible pain and damage, they still exist within the church?
Oh, absolutely. One of the things, yeah, of course they do, because that teaching has not changed. What has changed is the fact that we have now, at least in the global north, but not necessarily in other parts of the world, where the church's numbers are going through the roof, like in Asia and Africa, the truth of the matter is that in the global north and in the home of Judeo-Christian tradition, people now are educated. They know about their rights, and adults now walk away from the church if they feel that they want to, because they can. Now, the church would say they cannot, but people know they're perfectly entitled to, you know, their human dignity, their human rights. Say, of course, they can. The church, the Catholic Church in particular, like a number of other major faith systems in the world, it's not alone in this regard, has really yet to come to terms with the whole idea of individual autonomous human rights. It hasn't come to terms with that. And I think that's part of the problem, because when we're talking about the mother and baby report, I mean, I was very, very taken, I have to say, surprised by the speed and the humility, can I say, of the apologies and the analyses offered by a number of bishops and by the religious orders, because frankly that did not happen with the Ryan report, the Murphy report, and other reports that we have had. That didn't happen. There was a reluctance, there was a resistance, there was a pushback.
Yeah,
but this time, did you not think so? I thought
I definitely thought it clearly. The Bon Secours nuns who ran Tuam came out very quickly with an apology.
Yeah.
And I suppose, look, it doesn't matter what you or I thought of it, but the apology was probably better received by survivors, certainly as articulated by Catherine Corliss, than the government apology was.
Well, I think that because there might have been a suspicion that past practice would have happened again, that either you'd have had to wait for a long time for an apology, or it would have been half-hearted, or it would have been self-justifying. That didn't happen, I think, this time. I mean, insofar as I've read the reports, the apologies from the Bon Secours, but also from a number of the bishops in whose diocese there were a number of these institutions, I have been pleasantly surprised at the attempt at honesty in them, the acceptance that the church must take a huge amount of the responsibility for the way in which it exercised control. You know, much of this control was exercised in relatively unsubtle ways. But here we are in a situation where today, you know, we have church teaching on sexuality, we have church teaching on homosexuality, and 90% of our children at primary level are still going to Catholic schools, and 60% of our children are going to Catholic schools at second level.
So do you think the church still wields a lot of power in this country?
Yeah, I'm not arguing that we should close down those schools. I think they have done a superb job and still continue to do. But what is missing here is what is identified in this report. And I think this report is a magnificent work of scholarship, may I say. I think it's a superb work of scholarship. It's cool. It took 5 years. It is cool though it is. It is completely replete with compassion. But what it points out is what is striking.
Mary, again,
let me finish that.
Yeah.
Striking is how easy it was to sacrifice children. Children were the ultimate sacrifice, along with women here, but children were sacrificed, you know, to false respectability, to narrow notions of what constituted family, to set narrow, ludicrous notions of sexual morality. And that's the problem now, that we really need to engage in a discussion with our educators and with the church as to how children's rights, their right to their freedoms, freedom of information, freedom of conscience, freedom of belief, can be, how reassured can we be that these are now fully respected from day one when they enter those education systems?
So you are saying that the church, we'll come back to the report in a sec, you are saying that the church still wields huge power in this country.
Do you not think so? If it's running 90% of our primary school.
Yeah, you see, we think that we tend to kind of take for granted it doesn't. Yeah.
Yes. Not to mention our healthcare systems. I mean, let's not think that this report, important though it is, and I think it's an extraordinarily important archive, and I would like to congratulate the authors who put 5 years of their lives into this. Let's remember who they were. Nobody knows more about this story apart from the women and someone, you know, an extraordinary heroine like Catherine Corliss, and the women who suffered through their experiences in these institutions. There are probably few people in the world who know as much about the situation as these three people do and the team of people who work with them.
But Mary, I'd have to say to you on that obviously a lot of the survivors do feel differently. They feel they know more. And I think, you know, I got the impression that, the way the worst thing you could do to somebody who's been abused is to gaslight them and tell them it doesn't happen. And I kind of feel that a lot of them feel they were not heard here. And they've been told, the report says women weren't forced into these places, but they had no choice. They feel the physical abuse was played down. This notion that, we can't prove there were foreign adoptions for money. And the women are saying, but it's there. Look at my story. There.
Yeah, but
there
you have
it
to
is.
You have to remember this is a report that is going to have to stand the test of scholarship, of scholarly analysis, of profound research. These women have important stories to tell. Every one of them has their own story to tell, and I agree absolutely that it's so important that those stories are given absolute respect. But then you take all the stories and you analyze them and you research them and you try to tell an overall narrative. And as the report says, from the very get-go, you're dealing with complexities that are so profound that you're probably never going to be able to satisfy. The hurt, the rawness, the woundedness, the need for vindication, the need for apology, the desire for sorrow, and the lives that can never be restored to them. I think in fairness to those who wrote the report, but also in fairness to those who, in a sense, whose lives are the subject of the report and who committed to telling their stories so the report could be written, that there is certainly going to be fallout. But I also would say, and I think it's important to say, that this report is a very important piece of archival information for us as a nation. It's a very, very important report that tells us that it navigates us through, you know, from the 20s right through to the 90s. It tells a story of a changing Ireland, a changed Ireland, but an Ireland that also needs to continue to change. I mean, a very simple thing that is not actually that simple in the end of the day, but is remarkable, is that here we are, and we've discussed children's rights for years, and yet adopted children still do not have the right to their own birth information. And it's wonderful to know that the Attorney General now, Paul Gallagher, he believes that we do not need a constitutional referendum in order to be able to ameliorate that and give that right to adoptees.
Do you agree that right does not need to be balanced against a mother's right to privacy, or how would you work that one?
Well, that's the difficulty, isn't it? And I think here we're hearing, this is exactly where you get into arguments now, because the document, the report acknowledges that there may be circumstances in which a woman will have, who would give up a child for adoption, will have a very strong need to protect the secrecy of her relationship and of her of having given birth to that child. But everybody seems to be agreed on the Commission, and indeed a number of children's rights organisations argue, that the child's rights trump the right of the mother in this regard, except in exceptional circumstances. And that's what the report is saying. And so here is a debate that we're going to have to have.
Yeah.
And this is why I say, if we go back to the report, what I found most striking about it, Brendan, is how easy it was for all of us, society, church, the law, to completely overlook the children. Never to mind, you know, one of the most ghastly parts of it, of course, is the children who simply disappeared off the face of the earth, the 9,000 babies who just plain died and overlooked, forgotten. But there's also, I mean, if you go back a little bit earlier, but back in 1987, a guy called Joe Robbins, I don't know if you remember Joe's book called The Lost Children,
No. Told
the story of Ireland from 1700 to 1900. And it was the story of charity children, you know, orphaned, illegitimate, abandoned children in Ireland. Tens, and I mean tens of thousands of children disappeared off the face of the earth. Unknown, unheard of again, sent off to foster homes, sent off to workhouses, sent off to institutions, simply disappeared. So in a sense, what we're looking at is a culture that built on that, how easy it was to overlook children. They had no voice. They had no rights. They had nothing, not even an entitlement, even today, to know their full identity. And I think that's something we have, as part of what we have to redress, as well as redressing, you know, the hurt that was caused to those women who entered institutions where, as we heard from the report, their children had less chance of survival than if they had given birth to them practically on the side of the road.
Yeah. It's good that you put that challenge to us now about that culture could still be there and within the church and the power they have, because we can tend to feel a bit smug about our modern state when we look back at these times. I suppose the other big aspect that we look back on now and feel we're better than that now is the misogyny of it all. Do you think
Correct,
we are better
which has
than
not
that
changed.
Now?
which has not changed.
Really?
I don't think so. Do you think so? Do you think that the church is less misogynistic today than it ever has been? I doubt it very much.
I suppose, is it more subtle about it, Mary?
No, I don't. We could argue with that all day, but I don't think so. I don't think it has ever taken its role as a conduit of misogyny for generations seriously. I don't think it's ever researched it. I don't think it's ever analysed. I don't think it's ever tried to come to terms with the damage it's done and to redress it or to address it. But I do think that this report is an important, it's an important embarkation point for us, I think, as a community. It tells us a lot about our history and our past. It tells us a lot about our present. It gives us navigational tools in terms of its recommendations for where we need to get to. And, you know, people I'm sure are able to pick it apart and see imperfections in it. I see a very important backstop here. I see this is a very important result of Catherine Corliss calling for us, you know, from a day when bodies were found in a field, and saying, what on earth went on here? And we didn't know. Now we know. And that's important because we're not able to run away from those truths. We're not able to use techniques of neutralizing it. It's in that document. And I have to say, I was very impressed by the scholarship of the document.
Okay.
That some people might think because it's, you know, it's a bunch of lawyers and historians, they might find the, you know, the language of scholarship sometimes can appear, not so much distant, but objective. But I do think
Mary, can I put huge compassion.
Okay,
can I put one thing to you on that just before you go? There's a text here from Katrina Crow. I don't know if you heard Katrina Crow on Claire Byrne yesterday. And she was talking about a friend of hers who, you know, said that the story she told was not accurate. And we heard that woman on Claire Byrne the day before. Katrina Crow texts, what does Mary think about the fact that some witnesses' testimony has been inaccurately represented and all testimony has been largely paraphrased instead of using their own words? And another texter, Mary Penny Crowley from Kenmare, saying, did Mary not see Noel Brown on The Late Late and the hurt, particularly that her testimony was not accurate? It's Noel Brown was the name I was searching for there. Her testimony was not accurate in the report. Astounded.
I think that's tragic if that is what, you know, and to the extent that that has happened, I'm sure that those who authored the report would themselves be desperately embarrassed to know that the information that they have recorded was recorded imperfectly, because that really is, it's so disrespectful, isn't it, to the people who gave the information.
Yeah, but they were asked by Claire Byrne's show the other day to comment on it, the three people who wrote the report, and they said they would not be commenting on it.
Well, that's, you know, again, I can't speak for them, Sir Brendan.
I know. Should they come out and talk?
Nor do I feel I have to defend any parts of the report.
Absolutely. I'm sorry, Mary. It's just that is very much the thrust of the text coming in. So I wanted to ask you.
The people who gave that information are perfectly entitled and must have their say in relation to it. It's not for people like me to say that the rights and wrongs of that. I think that we have to listen to them. And if they have serious complaints, take those complaints very seriously, because it would be desperately disrespectful, would it not? If at the end of this process, in which we've invested so much and from which we hope so much good might come for the individuals and also for us as a community, if it is the case that there is continuing disrespect for these women, then that would be unacceptable, would it not? So let's let people have their say. The report's only out a few days. It's taken me today to get the whole, all of it, every word of it read. To listen to the women as they tell their story, and to the extent that if information is paraphrased, has that skewed the story? Has it made the story less credible? Or so those are kind of questions for the analysis that will happen for the women who made their responses and who are perfectly entitled to pick it apart. Also, I think for other researchers and for scholars to look at the report and do what scholars do, take it apart. But I honestly think, from my point of view, when I look at the report, I think it gives us navigational tools to get to a much better future, to a series of much better debates about our children's rights, about misogyny, about how we treat women, about what do we regard as a family in Ireland? And when we had this debate, when we had the world meeting of families, the Pope came to, And so many families, you know, divorced and remarried, single, children of gay families, all excluded.
Yeah.
All excluded by one of the key influencers in our country, which is the Catholic Church.
Yeah, I didn't know that a single mother family is not recognised under the Constitution as a family.
Well, there
I think
you
I
go.
Heard that during the week. Extraordinary. Listen, Mary, you know what? You're right that this has the report has been valuable in that it's given us a very valuable conversation this week. And you would just hope now that in the culture we live in, where things swoosh up and swoosh down again, that we won't forget to continue having this conversation. And I know that people like you will not let this kind of conversation go. So look, thank you very much for joining me this morning.
My pleasure. Thank you very much indeed. Thanks, Brendan.
Thanks, Mary. We'll take a break.
Text 51551. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.